not up to us to rescue the reef, but we need to give it space to recover. It can recover itself. It can bring itself back to health if we give it space, if we stop kicking it. Climate change is it's the biggest threat, and it's trying to fight that. And then there's all the other scenarios that it's also been placed in, which is poor water quality. The shipping that's going to be going through the reef is going to increase from 3,000 ships to 8,000 ships. It's fighting on so many fronts, and we are just not giving it a chance to help itself.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Today, we have something rather different for you. Melbourne-born writer and journalist Anna Crean has penned essays, fiction and poetry, and she won the Australian Press Council Award when she was just 18. Her latest work, titled The Long Goodbye, Coal, Coral and Australia's Climate Change Deadlock, has been written for the Quarterly Essay. It's a deep dive into the psychology and politics of climate change in Australia. With the backdrop of the release of the Finkel Review and the revelation that the Great Barrier Reef is worth $56 billion, her work paints a picture of dysfunction and dissent on this vital issue. Anna, who's on tour to talk about her work, joins us today to discuss the essay. Anna Crean, you've previously written about the environment and the economy in your book Into the Woods, with a focus on the Tasmanian wilderness. How did you come to undertake this new project?
Well, I think I was in a state of despair in a way. I think, like many Australians, I was watching the state of politics and the sort of degraded value of democracy, and just felt an incredible sense of powerlessness and inaction at all levels of government in terms of tackling climate change. So when I did take on this project, it was actually quite invigorating, in the sense that I found I could drill down into the facts and the statistics and also the anecdotal evidence as well, which I find really valuable.
Obviously, your research was quite extensive. You travelled the Great Barrier Reef to Bowen and Townsville in Queensland. You were in Port Augusta in South Australia, as well as doing the more general research. Just tell us, out of all this work, what's your main conclusion?
One of the most interesting things I learnt was that Shell, in 2008, the petroleum company, released two scenarios which would see us through to 2050. And it's kind of an irony that a fossil fuel company has been factoring in climate change in their strategic planning since the 80s, as opposed to an Australian government in the 21st century. But they had two scenarios, and one was called Blueprints and one was called Scramble. And Blueprints was a scenario in which the global agreements were held in goodwill and there was a transformation. It was difficult, but governments came on board, as did the public, in terms of transforming the electricity sector and bringing climate change to a halt. And the other scenario was Scramble, which is global agreements were undermined, there was political opportunism, politicians were too scared to take a hit from popularity-wise, and the entire transformation was undermined in terms of people fighting for the last resource over fossil fuels. And the result was, you know, a devastated economy as well as a devastated ecosystem. And come 2050, well, the Scramble scenario was in the same place as the Blueprint scenario, in the sense that there needed to be a switch to renewables, there needed to be a transformation in the way we tackle these kind of issues. But the result is a costly, devastating and tragic landscape.
It is a bit strange, isn't it, that this issue has turned into a version of the culture wars. We've got the climate wars. Of course, it's a difficult issue anyway, and there'll be winners and losers along the way of transformation. But why do you think it's become so ideological?
Yes, it's steeped in an ideological bog, isn't it? I think in one way it's easier to run a scare campaign than it is to present a nuanced and sensitive and complicated policy. I do think we have a political system that's been somewhat captured by the fossil fuel lobby in a way that we are have politicians very much in thrall to the fossil fuels influence and incredible access to lobbyists, and become a bit of a transit lounge as well for politicians and their staffers in taking jobs after their ministerial responsibilities wind up into the fossil fuel lobby. And as a result, we have this world that's become quite separate from the public. And when there are legitimate worries and people are going to struggle and they are going to lose their jobs, and it's not just due to climate change action, but it's also due to the effects on manufacturing, automation, all that kind of thing. And you have these people being left behind and abandoned. And obviously it's easier to drive a kind of toxic culture baiting wedge between these regions and between voters as opposed to doing the job that needs to be done.
In your extensive travels, did you find stakeholders all happy to talk? You spoke to activists, to power workers, to scientists, or were some more reluctant to engage with you than others?
Politicians in general were reluctant to engage. That's to be expected. In terms of, I think probably the most revealing town that I went to was Port Augusta in South Australia, which is a town that is a coal-fired power station town and vastly reliant on that industry. And yet in 2012, significant people in that town, power workers, the councillors, the mayor, they all looked to the horizon and they could see what was on it, and it wasn't coal. And they came together and tried to embrace the future, and been trying to promote ever since a solar thermal storage plant. And they'd got a site, they'd got businesses interested, they'd done all the data, and they had actually responded to transition with enthusiasm and positivity, and they were ignored. They too were abandoned. And this is what happens whether, you know, change is embraced or change is not embraced, is that the people who are going to be affected have been completely ignored and blindsided.
Is this a case of people on the front line knowing that things are inevitably going to turn bad for them, being able to see that they must do something, so they become proactive?
That's right. So Port Augusta, it was a brilliant example of their bubble being punctured and trying to embrace the future and trying to make sure that their town could survive through the end of coal, and just completely ignored. In the same way, the Great Barrier Reef, if you want to look at it from an economic perspective, I mean, the federal government released a study in 2013 which said that there are 69,000 jobs generated each year from the Great Barrier Reef. And the Great Barrier Reef is in incredibly poor condition, and that's again another government agency. The Marine Park Authority have said this. And I mean, armed with this information, you had the former Environment Minister, Greg Hunt, go to UNESCO countries to lobby for the Great Barrier Reef not to be put on the in danger list when it is very much in danger.
I wonder whether there was a change in attitude to the reef, because I do remember when President Obama, here for the G20, made that speech about the importance of the reef, and there was quite a lot of sharp blowback from the federal government, and yet not so many years on, as you say, the government was having to lobby internationally. Do you think that there was a change of attitude, or simply a change of tactics, as it were?
I'm not entirely sure what's going on in the deep, deep recesses of mind when it comes to the Great Barrier Reef. I mean, the facts are loud and clear when it comes to the condition of the reef. And to be playing politics with such a sustainable and incredible asset to the Queensland economy and to Australia in general is pretty devastating and heartbreaking. And I've kind of, as I've been touring this essay, I've came across an interesting change from climate change denialism to a new sort of blowback, which is climate change nihilism. So I'm having a lot of responses where people are saying, it doesn't matter what we do, the Great Barrier Reef is going to die. So let's just keep doing what we do, which is putting more coal onto the global supply and delaying the transformation to clean energy.
There is a strong sense of frustration that comes through your essay, most dramatically highlighted, I thought, in your admission that you wanted to throttle a man for his excitement over the Adani coal mine. Now, I should add that I think you kept your feelings completely under control and no doubt were impeccably polite. But did you seek to be objective when you were doing this research? And did you find that difficult, as you say, you started out, obviously, with some strong attitudes?
Yeah, I think this was probably my, this work is my most, I do have quite a strong stance by the end. And I think that's largely because I was meeting people on the front line, graziers and farmers and landowners out on the land, experiencing what journalist Paul Cleary says is possibly the biggest forcible transfer of land since the first white settlement. And not only that, to have an extremely fragile and precious water resource, which towns rely on, farms, graziers, to be compromised in the name of not only an industry that is, you know, seems to care for no other industry, but an industry that is ultimately being proven to have substantial damage to the planet.
So is your attitude that the coal industry should have no future in Australia?
When you say that, you get immediately you get a kickback saying you can't just close it overnight. And of course you can't just close it overnight. I think the problem is that we have an industry that has used up all the trust that the public can ever direct towards it. I mean, there's constantly been rolling out this idea of clean coal or carbon capture and storage. The irony being, particularly with that latter technology, carbon capture and storage, is it's not really going to get off the ground if you don't have a carbon price. But those economic instruments have been thwarted at every step of the way and over the past decade as well at government level. So I think that we have a very insincere industry when it comes to considering having genuine concern for A, the people that work directly for these coal companies, and the planet in general. I mean, this is in the face of science now.
So what do you think of the Finkel Report's proposed scheme, which many would say is perhaps second best to an emissions intensity scheme, the clean energy target he puts forward?
Right, so that was the Finkel report was a foot in the door, and we have come to a point in Australia where we just need to get that foot in the door. The door's been flapping in the wind for the past decade. Whenever an economic instrument has been proposed, it's been played politics with. So whether it's perfect or imperfect, or whether it's politically motivated, the Finkel review provided an opportunity to get the ball rolling. And what we have seen, which is not entirely unexpected, is a coalition backbench who is stifling it. And bizarrely, now we're apparently considering a suggestion from the Mineral Councils of Australia on how to go about transforming our electricity grid, which is just absurd. We've organised an expert panel to study this in detail, and yet now we're considering a suggestion from the Mineral Councils lobby.
Now, just to go back to your discussions with stakeholders, Indigenous communities are often conflicted about mining development. What did Indigenous leaders tell you about development in Queensland and Adani in particular?
Well, this is really a tricky landscape in itself, and I really resonated with Gareth Evans' comment about native title, which is it's the most complicated piece of legislation next to the Tax Act after John Howard's amendments. And it is an opaque, complicated process, native title, and in which traditional owners have the right to negotiate, but they're not allowed to have the right to not negotiate. And I think in particular with the situation of the Wangan and Jangalingu people, where Adani plans to basically dig up the coal, this is a situation with allegations of serious fraud and with serious evidence as well. And we have seen a political system that is keen to just ignore that, not look into it, and not see not checked that people's rights have been exploited and or run roughshod over in order to get a dubious and murky project off the ground.
And so how do you think that negotiations with Indigenous communities should be conducted, can be improved, especially when you get differences of opinion?
Yeah, I mean, and this is a really fraught area in the sense that if there's ever an argument for economic development or progress, it's the Indigenous argument. But too often it's been used as a card to play, in a sense, from certain mining companies of Indigenous jobs, so therefore you can't dispute the process or the regulation or the assessment with which these projects come to fruition. I think there needs to be transparency. I think the native title legislation is opaque for a reason. Outsiders are not really meant to understand it, and to tell you the truth, you get the sense that insiders don't really understand it either.
Now, just to wind up back on the Barrier Reef, your final words in the essay are, and I quote, "The reef isn't dead, but it can't breathe." Do you think that the community, the policymakers, Australia generally, are we up to the task of saving the reef?
The thing is, it's not up to us to rescue the reef, but we need to give it space to recover. It can recover itself. It can bring itself back to health if we give it space, if we stop kicking it. Climate change is its biggest threat, and it's trying to fight that. And then there's all the other scenarios that it's also been placed in, which is poor water quality. The shipping that's going to be going through the reef is going to increase from 3,000 ships to 8,000 ships. It's fighting on so many fronts, and we are just not giving it a chance to help itself.
Well, let's hope we do in the years ahead. Anna Crean, thank you for talking with us today. That's all for today's Conversation Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage, and we'll be back with you again soon. Goodbye for now.